This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll have another report for the Mass Casualty Commission on the Good Sentence with Paul McDougall. A Cape Breton musician salutes our veterans with a special project recognizing D-Day of the Second World War. And a Cape Breton Member of Parliament talks about the high cost of living and the government's efforts to help people weather the storm. These stories are coming up on the Coast. On The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall speaks with investigative journalist and author Paul Palango as he shares his opinion in his book 22 Murders, stemming from the shooting spree of April 2020.
Paul, why don't you start off telling our Coast listeners just a little bit about your background in investigative journalism and how you actually ended up living in Nova Scotia a number of years ago.
I started out as a journalist in 1974 at the Hamilton Spectator, and after a couple of years, I moved to the Toronto Sun, where I covered the Toronto Blue Jays in their first year, went to 200 baseball games. That really wasn't for me. Then I went to the Globe and Mail, and I was covered politics and eventually became an editor at the Globe and Mail, first as a sports editor, then city editor, then national editor, and I was in charge of investigative reporting, and we won a number of awards while I was doing that. And I left there in 1990, and then I wrote a book in 1993 on the RCMP, and that just got me started. Now I'm on my fourth, I've just done my fourth book on the RCMP.
Yeah, so that's one would say you pretty well know what you're talking about. So for anybody new to this whole, the story of you writing this book, this isn't just something that you thought, oh, I can do this book. You've got a background not only in the journalism and writing about it, but you even have a family that's been involved in policing in various aspects. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, they're all in corrections and, military police and things like that. My father, my brother, my daughter, my son-in-law. So there's a lot of law enforcement in my background, and as I said, the first three books I wrote on the RCMP, Above the Law, The Last Guardians, and Dispersing the Fog, were really about the state of the RCMP as it evolved. And over the course of those three books, from 1994 onward, I become ever more critical of the force and its inadequacies, and pointing out that bad things can happen with this force. And then when this happened in Nova Scotia, I happened to be living here. I moved here in 2001, and we have a glass business in Chester. And I'd largely retired from journalism, but when the massacres happened in April 18th and 19th, 2020, I felt that I would help other journalists tell their story. But when they didn't want to tell the story, I personally got involved in it and took it on as a project.
And, well, we all know what a very difficult story it was and is and continues to be. And so you first off started writing a number of magazine pieces. Some were in Maclean's, some were with the Halifax Examiner, Frank, and that. When did you get the inkling that you were probably, I would say you probably almost had to write this book? Is that right?
Yeah. That's right, because I didn't really want to write a book. I'd had a heart attack after each of my last two books. I wasn't in the best of health. I'd just been diagnosed with cancer when this started. And, as I said, I wanted to help other journalists tell the story, but the mainstream journalists didn't want to hear from me. I didn't think they had the proper sort of approach to doing this story. And a lot of them had sort of written me off as some sort of conspiracy theorist, which was really something generated by the RCMP, who didn't like the kind of stories I was doing. And I just sort of went with the flow. I said, you can call me a conspiracy theory. I'm going to prove my conspiracies. And that's what I set out to do.
Yeah, it's And basically, this is what you're doing in the book. So why don't you just tell our listeners, just give a little precis or whatever of the book and how you set about to do it and what you've done with it, which I should let listeners know is at this point it's now a national bestseller, Globe and Mail bestseller. It's an Amazon bestseller. It hit various categories as bestseller for Amazon, gang violence, sociology, policing, all these various categories. So people countrywide are reading it. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about, you know, what you set out to do with the book and what you did do, because the book is here now.
Well, when I looked at doing the book, I recognized, in the sort of late 2020 that, based on my experience and based on the stories I'd reported in my previous book, Dispersing the Fog, I could see that they're going to set up a public inquiry that was designed not to get to the truth. And I felt that someone had to write a book based on the available information and publish that book before or during the inquiry, so there'd be an alternate view of the story, a clear narrative about what likely happened. Not the conclusive story, but looking at what happened. And then when I approached the book, I had a situation where most people, you know, the government, the police, and many of the families would not talk on the record. So this presents an obstacle in telling the story. And the way around that obstacle was for me to basically create a journey. So the first part of the book becomes the coverage of the massacres and what happened and who the people were who were killed and some of the underlying issues. And the second part of the book is the search for the truth. So it's my search dealing with the mainstream media and the failings of the mainstream media, political correctness, wokeness, whatever you want to call it, and then meeting citizen journalists along the way, like people who wanted to contribute, citizen investigators who were finding out things here and there and becoming their sort of spokesperson in telling the story. So together with citizen journalists or citizen investigators, we uncovered a lot of facts and eventually put on the record a number of things that I don't think the police or governments wanted to be seen. And that sort of explains why we're in this sort of state now where the Mass Casualty Commission that's supposed to be investigating this has caused a lot of controversy, because people know there's an alternative story out there based on the facts. And I'm quite proud of that.
The book is it's a 560-page book. It's roughly came out under 2 years from when the 22 murders, which is also the name of the book, when it happened. Let's approach this from a writer's aspect. How did you, and as you said, you've had health problems, health issues, I believe your wife has had some health issues. How on earth were you able to get such a comprehensive and succinct and a well-written, the topic is very, very difficult, but the book is in a very matter-of-fact, easy way to read. How did you accomplish that in that time span? And you have it out before the MCC even got started.
Well, you know, the approach I took was I wanted to do something really un-Canadian in this sort of genre, make something really interesting and riveting. And it was a great story to tell. And I set a deadline for it. I mean, when I got the book contract, it was December 2020, and I promised to deliver a first draft of the book by the end of May, beginning of June 2021. So I allowed myself 5 months. And during that period, like when I first signed the contract, Craig Payette, my editor at Random House, he called me up. I'd never met him before, and he said, "How far are you along in the story?" I says, "I got about 60% of the story." He says, "By the time you finish the book, how much are you going to have?" I said, "About 90%. I said, "I'm not going to have the whole story, but I'm going to be pretty close." And then I sat down writing it in January 2021, near the end of January, basically. And then over a 140-day period, I wrote basically a 2,000-word essay every day for 140 days, and interlinked in a very sort of fictional sort of style of narrative, but it's all facts. So I wanted to make people tell a story that people would find easy to read with a lot of issues being addressed, but in a very almost a fictional way. I've had people actually call and contact me and say, I was in the fifth chapter and I realized this is real, it's not fiction. And I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, it's very real. And so you take people through, you know, the events, which is difficult enough, and then there's quite a detailed analysis of the murderer and people he knew, acquaintances, civilians, and possibly criminal types, and then the whole role of the RCMP in this. And you call the RCMP administration the White Shirts, and it's from the book. It's the RCMP on the ground. If you have an argument with anybody, it's not necessarily with those people, but it seems to be like the whole culture or the fabric of the institution of how the RCMP is run is problematic. Am I correct in interpreting that's the way you look at the situation?
Absolutely. I've been called, like the RCMP will call me an RCMP hater. I've never been, you know, I'm looking right now, I've got a copy of a print of the musical ride charge that was given to me by RCMP detachment in British Columbia, because they, you know, this was years ago, and they thought, I'm here supporting the rank and file guys. And that's what I've always done, that they're working in a horrible situation, sort of a broken culture, very oppressive sort of situation, and the White Shirts, you know, inspectors and above, have essentially detached themselves from everyday policing, and they've left it up to the people on the streets to do all the policing and make all the decisions, but they're also the fall guys then, and they get blamed for everything. And if you look what's going on in the MCC right now, it's all the people who are below the rank of inspector who are being called on and basically vilified for what happened, but they had no supervision at this, you know, when these events happened, and the supervisors basically ran for cover and are still running for cover.
You discuss a lot of things in the book, and if someone was reading it, like say you finished the book a few weeks ago, there's things are coming out in the MCC now that appear to be as revelations when people read them or hear of them, but You've already said it in even better detail than what's coming out of the MCC, and you wrote it in a book that's been published 2 months ago. But how do you reconcile that?
What wrote it a year ago.
Yes, that's right. So it's like it's a strange. It must be a strange situation for you to see this, whereas you have it in the book, and you know there's thousands of people have read your book by now.
Yeah, I what I wanted to do is exactly that, though. Put on the record what was known from my own investigation and of the, you know, and the reporting of others a year ago. And I put that on the record to force the MCC to deal with it, because my, you know, my suspicion was they were going to try to bury as much as they could. And I put detail after detail after detail. And it is kind of ironic watching and disturbing watching you know, the daily media picking up this stuff and reporting it as new. Much of what they're reporting is new, they've already reported a year or two ago. They have no sort of monitor or sort of institutional memory of what they themselves did. And so they're being, you know, and what this means to the audience is that, you know, the Mass Casualty Commission is throwing out all kinds of information with no sort of coherent strategy and no coherent narrative. And various media are picking up the stories, and everyone's telling a different story. So for the public, it's hard to understand what's going on. That's why I wrote the book. I want you to understand this is what's going on. And I leave it up to the Mass Casualty Commission to prove me wrong. And they haven't done that so far, have they?
It doesn't appear to be so, and there's still months more to go with this. Do you now you spend a lot of time on the notion that the murderer could have been involved with various illegal criminal gangs and possibly was an informant, and so there's all kinds of this. This has all been going on almost since day one. You paint a picture of how various things could or could not happen. Do you think the MCC is going to ever get into any of that?
Well, what they've assiduously done, if you look at the Mass Casualty Commission, and people said, well, how can you write a book where in the title you call it a cover-up before the Mass Casualty Commission even sat down to talk about it? Well, I knew what they were going to do from my own sources and my own experience. And what they've done is created this convoluted narrative, but they're not dealing with the initial things in a narrative that you as an audience would want to hear. What was his wife doing, the last person who supposedly saw him? What was her story? We haven't heard that. People who worked for him, he had a number of people who worked around him or were with him, and neighbors who contacted, we don't hear from them. They're assiduously avoiding any sort of contact or discussion about his criminal behavior over the last 25 years, because to get into his criminal behavior and who he was associating with and what he was doing begs the question, what did the RCMP do? What did the police know about him, and what files did they have on him? The police don't want to release those files or any of that information. So this is part of the cover-up, not discussing the criminal behavior and the criminal contacts of Werben over the years.
Do you think it's possible that some of that material could actually end up being brought forward, but without actually revealing some aspects if they're had to be not revealed because of the way the RCMP and other police organizations do criminal investigations into major gangs and criminal activity? Is there a way that the commission, if they want it, they could get some of this without possibly not having to reveal it everything or whatever? Do you think there's some way that could be done?
Well, you know, the commission said from the beginning, former Mr. Justice Michael McDonald said, we are transparent, we're independent of the RCMP, but they're not acting in a transparent way. You either put it out there or you don't put it out there. You don't do a sort of a bit of a striptease, because who are you protecting? I mean, the biggest issue here, right, that's coming up on June 13th, is the videotapes from the Enfield Big Stop, which the MCC would not release, which if you've seen them, and Frank Magazine has obtained some of them and released some of them, the story told by the videotapes does not match with the story that the RCMP is telling and told to the MCC. So you have to ask yourself, why are the RCMP lying about killing Werben and the way they killed him? The public would give them a pass for killing him. I mean, he was a heinous murderer who killed 22 people. Why are they not telling the truth about this? And so this battle's coming up on June 13th, where Frank Magazine and a number of media outlets, CBC, CTV, Global, the Canadian Press, are going to make arguments that everything has to be released, because that's what transparency is.
It's interesting when you talk to transparency, because it was just reported a couple of days ago that a new temporary or acting superintendent by the name of Ferguson, I think. He's just been appointed to like Nova Scotia, whatever. And then the Chronicle Herald said, quoting, the RCMP did not make Ferguson available for an interview after announcing he would be replacing Chief Superintendent Chris Leather, who himself had served as an interim. But, like, it's kind of ironic, right, with all this going on, and you appoint a new person who then, a couple of comments made, is going to try to improve things and do things better, but you can't interview me. I mean, what's changed?
The other thing that they didn't really anticipate was you know, when they appointed Douglas, they didn't. Or when they appointed Ferguson, they didn't say much about him. They said the usual things. He's a wonderful guy, and he does all these things. Da 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 da. And I found within about 10 minutes, I found a court case that he's involved in, involving other members in the RCMP that raised serious questions about his leadership and his claims about being a great leader. So it's. They're in a box. You know, the RCMP has the you know, I quoted a former deputy commissioner who said the RCMP has no top talent left at the force. They've basically been struggling for many, many years, decades. And we're seeing the result of that, what's happening now in Nova Scotia. I mean, what has happened is Mounties and other police I've talked to say that nobody wants to go to Nova Scotia. They you know, they say we're hated there now, and you know, we need things to resolve themselves. And I don't think that's ever going to happen if they keep playing the game the way they're playing, because they're not being honest, they're not being forthright, they're not being transparent.
22 people died because of one man and what he was obviously, it seems, trying to hide on that fateful night back then. We've come, it's 2 years into it now. This has impacted family, friends, citizens, people that may not have known any of those people. It's a true tragedy and traumatic effect. And we have the commission here now. Do you see, is there something good? It's supposed to be all wrapped up in a report done in November. And we'll see if that happens. But do you see any glimmers of good will come out of whatever report they do release?
Not until they address the issues of the failings of the RCMP. I mean, we've seen the hints of it here and there. But, you know, if we're going to have a police force that refuses to be held accountable, that's the good thing, as far as I see that the people of Nova Scotia recognize how poorly trained and how unaccountable the RCMP has been and is and continues to be. I mean, there's been no sense of contrition by this force, no sense that they want to fix things. I mean, if you look at, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the head of the RCMP union was quoted in the Globe and Mail in a front page story saying that the RCMP response on April 18th, 1920 was textbook response. And do you or anyone think that from what you've seen, that this is textbook? The poor communication, the undermanning, the allowing Werman to get away, no putting out of a public alert? There's nothing textbook about any of this. I mean, if it was a textbook, it was policing for dummies. And, you know, 22 people died, and that has to be addressed. It's not going away. I'm not letting it go away. And I don't think the people in Nova Scotia are going to let that go away until there's an explanation for what really happened.
You're not letting it go away. Is it going to be, I mean, this is going to go on for a while, and maybe some new information will come from some sources. Are you considering a follow-up, a fifth book?
Well, you know, I'm planning on not writing a fifth book, but I may have to. I mean, just before I got on the phone with you, I was on the phone with a new source providing new information that has not been addressed by the Mass Casualty Commissioner or the RCMP in the past. So it's going to keep moving forward, and, you know, me and the citizen investigators and the citizens of Nova Scotia, I sense they're rallying towards this now, and they're putting pressure on the government, because you got to ask yourself, where is the government in all of this? The Premier of Nova Scotia said that when he was campaigning for office that he would get to the bottom of what happened. And we're sitting here finding out that the force is unaccountable, that you know, the Mass Casualty Commission is allowing Mounties not to testify because they're too traumatized, et cetera, et cetera. What is the government going to do here? The government seems to be taking the position, well, our hands are tied. The government of Nova Scotia oversees the police in this province. The taxpayers of Nova Scotia pay for those police. We have to be able to hold them accountable.
That's a great place to probably end our talk for today on. I'd like to thank you, Paul Palango, for talking about his book, 22 Murders, subtitle, Investigating the Massacres, Cover-Up and Obstacles to Justice in Nova Scotia. It's available pretty well everywhere, locally, in bookstores, online. There's a second printing of it coming up, and it'll have national bestseller on it. So this is a big deal. I've described the book before. If you want to learn more about all this, the book is here. We'll continue to follow what you and others have to say about it. Maybe some good will come out of the MCC. Maybe changes will happen. We'll have to wait on to see that. And why don't you just to close out? How about giving us the last sentence in your book?
Well, the last sentence of my book. It's funny. I was writing the book, and I was writing that last chapter, and it just worked right down to the last sentence. It just sort of came out organically. And the last sentence of the book is, what's the big secret?
Sydney Victoria MP Jaime Batiste says the Liberal government has been burning the candle at both ends, dealing with the high cost of living, the war in Ukraine, and COVID-19. He says 2022 has been an eventful year, but Ottawa is doing what it can to help find some sense of normalcy.
Yeah, it's been pretty full. You know, the war in Ukraine has really caused a lot of ripple effects all across Canada. We're feeling with increased prices of things like gas, and affordability continues to be out there, and a lot of that's from the illegal war that's going on out there, but also a lot of the supply and demand issues we're having from COVID, where there was a little bit of people took time off because of all of the you know, urgency around getting the vaccines and us needing to slow down. But you know, we're slowly beginning to bounce back from that. We've got some great news out of Canada today that, you know, jobs are at an all-time high. You know, the unemployment rate is an all-time low. And this is great news for places like Cape Breton that continue to see the growth and development. We just kind of want to continue moving in the right direction. You know, the pandemic isn't quite over yet. We know that times have changed, and the vaccines are working, and our ability to handle this disease has increased. But we also know that, you know, there's always going to be mutations. That's one of the things that the World Health Organization has really told us. It's not a matter of if the virus mutates, it's when, and if we catch it in time. And so, you know, we're still very cautious on these things, but also making all of the world also passing legislation to make sure that making life a little bit more affordable for Canadians.
Jaime, I don't think anyone listening will think these decisions resulting in high rates of inflation are coming from the office of the MP, but certainly some of your constituents are making some tough decisions, and we're hearing people are being forced to eat less because of the rising costs of fuel and food. And but are community leaders such as yourself, is your government taking this seriously?
Oh, absolutely. We're taking it seriously. But we're also noticing that all across the world, we're seeing inflation rates rise. And Canada has had one of the lowest inflation rates. You know, when you look at the United States, you look at the Czech Republic, you look at the United Kingdom, inflation is, far greater in those areas than they are in Canada. But that's not to say we're not taking this these matters seriously. It's just a matter of, with economic theory and inflation, what is the answer? And the biggest thing is how we need to ensure that we have more supply that decreases the demand, or at least keeps up with the demand of what people want out there. But you know, there's a lot of people working, and there's a lot of money out there, and sometimes when there's a lot, you know, if you look at the theory of economics, when a lot of people are working, when a lot of people have money, things go up. And this is caused by many factors. What isn't clear is what is the solution to fixing that. If we put more money out there for people, then do we just increase that inflation rate. And the question, but the biggest thing is that as members of Parliament, we have to trust in the Bank of Canada to make the right decisions. And this is why it's filled with economists and bankers and people who know far more about economics than I do to make these decisions. And we put our faith in them.
Yeah, Jaime, I certainly wouldn't put you on the spot. And when it comes to some of the complicated economics involved in, or being an expert on calculating the price of fuel, and surely if you could figure out a way to help people weather the storm, especially those with low incomes, you would certainly. But we're told that the war in Ukraine and being on the tail end of COVID are the main reasons for the skyrocketing prices. Is it really that simple, though? Both events having a global impact, like you said, Canada, one of many countries dealing with this. But do you think it's a convenient time for the large corporations to rake it in? Many are saying it's a classic case of opportunism.
You know, we've heard that that narrative, and one of the things we've said is we're making sure that people are paying their fair share, especially businesses. We are looking into if there is collusion being happening out there by some of these big businesses in terms of what they're doing around gas prices. We are looking into those things, but majority of this is coming from being at the tail end of COVID, but also a legal war that's people aren't buying from Russia anymore, whether it's wheat, whether it's fertilizer, whether it's gas, and that means the rest of the resources around the world. You've got all of these countries all fighting for the same, we're all buying the same products from areas that are not Russia. So there's a limit in the supply. So of course, when the demand is so high, rates go up, and this is something that we're dealing with, and this is something that we're trying to figure out how we can create more autonomy for Canada to be an agricultural superpower ourselves, and to figure out how we can grow more of our own food. And I think it's an important time for Canada to reflect on how much we do in terms of international trade, and how much we're really taking a look at what we can do in our country to making sure that we're self-sufficient. And I think that's the important things we need to continue to look at. But, there are so many factors involved in when the world is facing inflation problems of saying, what are we doing and what can countries do about it? But if you look at the inflation rates of other countries compared to where we're at in Canada, that we're faring better than most. But that doesn't mean that it's not hard times for a lot of people. But, with the sooner we get out of this war, the sooner that we're making sure that Ukraine is victorious in this war, the better for our entire country and for countries around the world that this escalation in this war ends.
A lot of people would agree that trends are leaning more towards green alternatives. And I'm just wondering if you would weigh in on this narrative. Do you think it's foreshadowing that the gas-powered vehicles will soon be a thing of the past, making way for electric vehicles? And maybe the oil companies are just making hay while the sun shines, if you know what I mean.
Well, maybe, but I think they're all transitioning, and I think that we all have to transition to that eventually. But it's tougher for other places. Like I was talking to some of my members from Northwest Territories, and for them to get off diesel, it's going to be a lot harder for us in Cape Breton. So there's. And then there's always going to have people who have the anti-cars. I don't see a world where we entirely figure out how to get off of gas and oil. But I think the biggest thing is how do we correct the emissions? It isn't going necessarily after the industry of gas and oil. It's making sure that we're making sure that the emissions created by gas and oil are more clean. And that's part of the announcement we had this morning with the Veshuren Center. We're making everything greener. We're doing our best to making things carbon neutral. This is a part of the future that we have to move towards, because that's the future of our country. But the future of the planet is if we figure out how to reduce emissions. So this is all part of it. But I think that what our government is focused on is making sure that we get to net zero. But I don't see a world in 20, 30 years that we remove ourselves from oil and gas completely. But we figure out a way to create less emissions and zero emissions.
There's a video making its round on the internet with the leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh. It seemed he was being heckled by the Conservative for a moment after using the term, I think it was hungry Canadians. But to be fair, at least the video I saw, there wasn't much context there. Mr. Singh was making a point along the line of taxing corporation profits. And were you in the House when this exchange happened? And maybe you can give a better sense of what was said.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that the back and forth sometimes can, some of the antics that we see from the conservatives can be a bit immature. And I don't think that they were laughing necessarily at Mr. Singh's comments, but the fact that they weren't giving him the respect to actually voice his concerns, I thought that was kind of disrespectful of them. And, you know, we do our best, especially, you know, those of us who are parliamentary secretaries or ministers who are on duty that day, of trying to hear the questions because we have to respond. And so it's often difficult when there's a lot of heckling and there's a lot of laughter, and, you know, because they know that they don't have to answer the questions, whereas we do. And so, you know, I think that we haven't, one of the great things about Zoom, one of the great things about doing question period virtually, if people were heckling, the speaker would know and that it was called out right away. But when there's so many voices in the house that you could hear, the speaker can't really do too much about it. And so I think that the hybrid mode that we've been able to do led to a more respectful exchange between parliamentarians. And I hope that we can figure out a way that that's the better system in the House of Commons. You know, coming from Indigenous communities, you know, we very much try to, you know, with our dinner discussions are very respectful, and we want to hear each other. A lot of times we will use, you know, talking circles and things like that to show that we're giving people the respect when they have their time to speak, that we're all listening. And it's a little bit of a different thing to come into these Commonwealth systems where heckling is accepted and almost encouraged by some parties.
Jaime, I know you don't have much time. You stepped out of the house here for this interview, and I can hear some of the activity in the background. You said you're working until midnight tonight. That's a pretty long day, huh?
Well, we want to make sure that we pass some legislation. We want to give ample time for debate and discussion around it. So we keep the house going until midnight, because there are people who want to speak to various bills and whether they're in agreement or disagreement. And we want to give them that opportunity. But we don't want to risk losing the opportunity to table things before we break for July to go back to our constituency and do some of the valuable constituency work. So we work late hours here. And so I'll be in the House of Commons till midnight, listening to debate, asking questions, doing what we do in the House of Commons, and talking to constituents as well. But it's all in hopes that we can get back to our constituencies where we can be seen, we can be visible. Hopefully a summer of actually getting to events and doing things in person as opposed to virtually. And I look forward to hopefully a full summer that has a little bit more normalcy than I've had during my time as MP, where we've been really challenged by all of the COVID measures that we've taken.
Speaking of looking forward to the summer, there's probably a lot of people around Cape Breton who would like to blow off some steam with a vacation, but traveling being so expensive, if we can use a familiar term for a moment, staycation, is there an opportunity here for Cape Breton tourism operators this summer for Capers to enjoy themselves around the island?
I think so, and I think we've got some great things. I mean, if you look at what we've done at Cape Smoky, our government just put another $950,000 into supporting it. We have a gondola. We have some of the most beautiful views. I think a lot of people in the Atlantic will be traveling to Cape Breton this summer, not just for the amazing views, but our golf, our you know, our seafood, our friendly nature. Hopefully, we've got a lot of music that I've been working with various folks about some of the music festivals that we've got going on this summer. And you can look around Cape Breton and Sydney area and see all the growth that we have going on. It's leading to, I think, Cape Breton and especially the Sydney-Victoria area being one of the top vacation destinations for all folks in the Atlantic. And, you know, just the amount of labor shortages within the airports and the different airlines these days are leading to so many delays and frustrations out there. I think that it's one of the good things is that if you can drive to a place like Cape Breton, there's no better place to spend your summer.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot to do here. Just before you go, do you care to share some of your favorite places to visit on the island when you get some time to unwind?
You know, Inganish is one of my favorite places to go for sure. I really like Inganish, and you know, they've got so much going on there. But you know, they have also Mike Kellaway's riding the Cabot Links and Cabot Cliffs, and if, you know, they're rated as the number one open golf destination and golf club in in the world by Golf Weekly magazine. I love that place. I haven't been able to golf yet this summer just because I'm here for majority of the time, but that's a place I definitely go to relax, as well as the Lakes Golf Course that's 20 minutes away from Escatoni. But I like spending a lot of time on the Bredouin Lakes with my friends who have boats and just go to the various beaches. You know, my place of tranquil is probably Goat Island. I like to go running there in Escatoni, doing the 2.2 kilometer, just a beautiful view. And if I can get some exercise in and then feel relaxed at the same time, that's a great way to spend your day.
Okay. Sydney Victoria MP, Jaime Batiste. Mr. Batiste, thanks so much for your time as usual. And if we're not talking soon, have a great summer.
All right. Thanks for the discussion. Take care.
And finally on Dialogue this week, Bill Bradley catches up with musician Keith Mullins about his tribute to those who sacrificed everything nearly 80 years ago when the Allied forces attacked the Germans on the coast of Normandy during the Second World War.
Fighting for freedom is a long road. It takes healing and it takes time. Fighting for freedom.
This year is the 78th anniversary of D-Day, and a gentleman knows that very well is Keith Mullins. Keith, you've been part of a very unique project since last year with the veterans. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's always great to be back, Bill. Thanks a lot.
And tell us a bit about what you've been doing with the veterans.
So Fabian Henry from Veterans for Healing, he's based near Inverness. We started a program, and the plan is to do it, I mean, at least once a year, maybe take it across the country, U.S. There's lots of plans, but basically what happens is I write songs with veterans. So I get stories. They don't even have to be musicians or anything. Just get their story, and then we kind of, like, write the song together, and then I take it home and record it. So last August, I did 6 songs in 3 days with 6 different veterans. And they were from all across Canada. One was Colonel Pat Strogren. Cindy Maysfield was from near Balls Creek or Point Edward or so, like around that area. Yeah, and we wrote the songs, and then I took them home, produced them, and played most of the instruments, and then we have an album.
And that album is available now, right?
It's available on Bandcamp. So if you go, I think it's keithmullins.bandcamp.com. I think pretty much all my stuff is up there. We just released this one, though, and 50% of the proceeds from album sales will go right back into Veterans for Healing, into, helping veterans, you know, in their healing journey.
And this being the 78th year of D-Day, such great importance, and the veterans get to tell their story through your songs, and I'm just picturing, and I'm not a songwriter, but I'm just picturing sitting down, talking to these veterans, and putting that material together. That must be really hard for you as a person to take their thoughts and put them together, and for them to actually tell you all about what happened to them.
Yeah, totally. I try to come in like very non-judgmentally, and like the way I write songs, there's always a silver lining. There's always hope, and there in life, that's the way that I feel. So when I talk to someone and they tell me their struggles, and I always say, well, you know, where's silver lining? You know, are you better for it? What did you learn? How can we grow from this? How can we get better? You know, so it's a real growing experience. Music is such a gentle therapy, you know, and it's such a gentle way for someone, you know, to help someone grow and learn without being too harsh, you know.
And this is something that will go on forever. People, the generations of families can play it for their kids and their kids. And you're also doing it again this August as well. Tell us a bit about that.
Yep. So we have another one. We do it in Inverness. Fabian, he lives in Piper's Glen. And we last time we did it at the Dusky Diamond in Inverness. And we got another batch of veterans from across the country, and we'll do it all over again. And I just love it. It takes me about 2 days to recover from it. I'm like, blah, at the end of it, because my mind is just mush. But it's so worth it. You know, it's probably some of the best work I've ever done, because they're real stories, and it's helping people. So that's where I get my juice from.
So is this something that's going to continue each and every year?
Yeah, at least once a year, I'd say, is the plan.
Okay, well, this is an awesome project. I have to commend you on this. And, of course, the veterans telling their story through song. And I just had to reach out to you and share this experience, because it's something that people need to know about.
No, thanks. Thanks for all your support at the Coast, Bill.
And just before we wrap up, here's Barry Pepper with Legion Magazine.
On June 6, 1944, 6,900 ships moved across the stormy English Channel under cover of darkness. At dawn, the sound of artillery filled the air. Frank Curry, a Canadian aboard a minesweeper, described the scene. British, American, and French cruisers and battleships opened up like the very gates of hell, he wrote. Overhead, thousands of Allied planes roared. The plan was to land 156,000 men on the beaches of Normandy, the largest invasion in seaborne history. They divided the coastline into five sections. The Americans landed at two beaches, codenamed Utah and Omaha. The British were given sword and gold. And the Canadians' 10-kilometer stretch of coastline was codenamed Juno Beach. The air and naval bombardment didn't take out all the enemy positions, and the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division waded ashore under withering machine gun fire. We had to go at least 50 yards before we got out of the sea, said Lockie Fulton of the Royal Winnipeg Rifles. It was something to see those bullets skipping at you like stones across the water. Those who made it to shore faced mines buried in the sand. Among the first wave that landed, one in two was killed or wounded. The Regina rifles landed in front of Courseulles-sur-Mer and were immediately pinned down by machine gun fire. Lieutenant Bill Grayson made it across the sand to the first row of houses. From there, he could see that machine gun firing in timed intervals. Between bursts, he ran to the position and threw a grenade through the gun slit. He chased the fleeing crew, and to his surprise, 35 Germans surrendered. With the gun out of action, A Company made it across the beach. On that day, there were 10,000 Allied casualties, including 1,074 Canadians. 359 Canadians gave their lives. But the invasion was a success, and it turned the tide of the war. In his diary, Prime Minister Mackenzie King wrote, "The hearts of all Canadians would be filled with silent prayer for the success of our own and Allied forces."
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.